Welcome, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your beleaguered accountant, Sandy Cohen, also known as Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is newly minted assistant professor of film history at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Is that a real place? I guess we're
just gonna say. State of mind.
And also, he's the world's biggest Alan Cumming fan, Mr. Matt Connolly. Matt, hit me with those mutant lungs.
I heard it on my Alan Cumming, but he's hard to do, actually. His voice is pretty, pretty rough. Weird.
Is he, he's Irish, Scottish?
Scottish.
Scottish. Yeah. Can you do a Scottish accent?
Ooh, I can't.
All right. Yeah, we'll knock back a few, like, shots of gin, and then we'll get full Nicky'd up. And then...
I only had one. Yeah. It's iced tea.
All right, and currently twirling his tassels as he saunters up to the mic is UW-Madison Media and Cultural Studies graduate student, Mr. Austin Morris. Hi, Austin.
Hi, I didn't get a haircut for the occasion, but I am wearing a wig right now.
Perfect. So yeah, we are all dressed for the occasion, because on today's show, we've got Cher, we've got Xtina, and we've got Tucci. That's right. It's another FlixWise favorites entry for 2018. This time, Austin's going to make the case for why Steve Antin's 2010. It just feels like it's from 1999. Jesus.
Wow, we're already launching.
I know.
Why Steve came out Antin's the same week as Sleepy Hollow,
yeah,
right?
Came from
Sleepy
Hollow, yeah. For why Steve Antin's 2010 musical Burlesque is one of the greatest films of all time. Austin and I have been planning this episode basically since we first met. This has been in the works for about a year now, I would say, probably. Yeah.
Yes, one of the first things I tell people when I meet them is that I love the movie Burlesque, yeah, and they need to watch it immediately.
Sure, and it basically tells everyone everything they need to know about you.
Honestly, it does.
Yeah. But we'll get into that. And now we are so grateful that Matt has graciously agreed to come on board and talk about it with us.
Oh my God, thank you for having me.
Yeah,
so exciting.
I'm very excited about this. but wait, before I give you the floor, I just really quickly need to preface your intro and pitch with a little explanatory note. Before we started recording, Austin and I discussed the possibility of finding someone to come on the show to play the naysayer, someone to highlight some of the less than exemplar elements of the style and storytelling. Maybe.
Austin just kind of...
What are those?
I know. Mystery to me. I don't know. But we decided against it. And the reason is this. Burlesque, for reasons we can discuss, does not have the greatest critical reputation. In fact, I would go so far as to say it's widely considered to be an appallingly bad movie. There's been a lot of ink spilled about the pleasures of watching a bad movie, ironically, and there are plenty of podcasts devoted to such pursuits. For instance, some of you may have heard of a little podcast called How Did This Get Made?, in which host Paul Scheer and company pick a supposedly crappy movie to dissect and laugh at it for an hour or so. And believe it or not, the very first episode of How Did This Get Made? Centered around the very movie we're discussing today. About Burlesque, Scheer says, "Burlesque is kind of like Moulin Rouge for really dumb people. It's like Showgirls was butt-fucked by Moulin Rouge, and then it charted and created Burlesque." Ahem, okay. First of all, homophobic, right? Damn, all right. Second of all, does it really take that much, I don't know, intellectual rigor to watch Moulin Rouge? I don't know. Lots of things wrong with that. We don't need to get into it. It was the very first episode of that show, and I have no idea if anyone involved with it stands behind their comments. My point is only that those who wanted to tear into the film have had their say. And we are not here to rip into Burlesque or revel in its flaws, but rather we are here to discuss its merits as a legitimate cultural and artistic achievement. With that in mind, what is Burlesque and why is it important? Talk to me, Austin Morris. Tell me all about it.
Oh, boy. All right. So Burlesque, like many other musicals, is the story of a small town girl with big city dreams. Christina Aguilera plays Allie. She is moving from Iowa. She hops on a bus. Yes, not a train. This is not a movie approved by the public transit proponent sector of the internet that I frequent. But... So she hops on a bus, better than driving in a car. She's too poor to have a car, frankly.
Yeah.
And she goes to L.A. and apparently spends all of the money that she had in L.A. in one day. Because when she finds the burlesque club that Cher runs, she's very hesitant to give Alan Cumming. We'll talk about that. Her last remaining $20 bill to get into the burlesque club. But she does, and what she finds changes her life, because she realizes that she has always wanted to be in performing in a burlesque club. I guess because she rents all of the LA County Library's books on burlesque, I'm pretty confident, and just like reads them in her apartment. Anyway, she realizes her dream of becoming a burlesque dancer for Cher and her business. And she gets the mentoring help of Stanley Tucci in one of his best My Gay Dad roles. Love him so much. A growing collection of those roles. And yet there aren't enough of those roles.
That's a little true.
And finds, you know, self-confidence and artistic expression through that. Meanwhile, the club might collapse into financial ruin because no one appreciates the art of burlesque, or insufficient numbers of people appreciate the art of burlesque. And in a conclusion that I won't necessarily spoil, real estate law becomes involved.
You mustn't spoil it. It's the heart of the movie.
It really is Deus Ex Air Rights.
Yeah.
With James Brolin, right? James Brolin.
Yeah, James Brolin. The slightest like hint of Barbara like thrown in there, right?
So I didn't think about that. That's so true.
So right? True. And along the way, Cher learns that people will come to hear people sing and do burlesque, because Christina obviously has to sing in this movie. It has to be a musical more than sort of a just dance musical. Christina falls in love with someone else's man, and then she falls in love with the wrong man, and there's just so much going on in this movie.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I would say about this movie is that it shows something that is not, movies don't do enough, which is that this movie ends up being about the solidarity between women and gay men, and especially in sort of the creative arts. I think it's really important. It's kind of analogous to Magic Mike and Magic Mike XXL in that way, actually. It's about sort of the economic struggles of the burlesque club and failure of Christina to like find her sort of dreams in a sustainable way. And I don't know, it's fun for all its flaws. It's like a fun, campy, glittery, good time. There's not a single frame of this movie that is like beige. It's got a lot of color. It's got a lot of glitter, a lot of fancy lights. Christina's voice is undeniable. Mm-hmm. It stops entirely for a Cher performance that's, like, better than it has any right to be. Mm-hmm. A classic Cher-Diane Warren pairing moment. It's delightful. So delightful that we have a shot of the admiring lighting person in the background just, like, nodding his head, like, yeah, man, this is good. And it is good. He's the audience surrogate of the entire movie, sure. Let's be honest.
And also tricked earlier by Nikki. Oh my god, Nikki.
We have so many things to say about the backup talent in this movie.
The backup talent. I mean, it's true, but yeah.
Christina's rival is played as Nikki, played by Kristen Bell. We also have Julianne Hough as a pregnant dancer going through a shotgun wedding in the movie. A shotgun wedding that is strangely lavish. Did I mention this movie The budget was north of $50 million, like $54 million, I think. It's quite expensive. I'm not sure how necessarily, but they spent a lot of money on this. Money,
yeah. On eyeliner, basically, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, the eyeliner
specifically
budget.
Specifically Alan Cummings.
Yeah, yeah, precisely, yeah.
Yeah, that was like an extra line in the budget. So like, oh, God, we've got a cast coming.
Exactly.
Throw
exactly.
in a few million for eyeliner.
Ooh, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's a good place to start. So, like, while we acknowledge that this is not a musical in the mode of, like, Vincent Minnelli, in that... Well, we can discuss. Like, it's certainly indebted to... There's a long, like, musical lineage in which it is indebted, but there are a number of curious ways in which it kind of doesn't quite hit the mark. And I guess, depending on your perspective, you either find those near misses very charming, or you find them kind of ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
At least that's kind of my assessment. But before we dive further into this, I'm going to ask my first question. And I always ask this question because I don't want to make any assumptions. I ask people if they like the movie first, and then every once in a while, like, David Bordwell comes at me with, like, no, I don't like Casablanca. Matt, how do you feel about Burlesque?
How do you feel about Burlesque? I like Burlesque.
Okay.
It's not a movie that I, like, came to immediately, I have to confess. So I didn't see it in theaters.
Okay.
I knew of its... How could you not know of its existence?
Sure.
But I first saw it with some friends, like, about a year or so after it came out on TV. Or someone. It was back when, like, DVDs were still a semi-viable option to watch, you know, for the mainstream. But I've come back to it over the years. You know, it's one of those movies that I feel like is on TV a lot. Mm-hmm. So whenever it sort of floats by, I'll watch 20 minutes. I do like the movie. I do think it has some flaws. But I think I like what you both said. Like, the flaws are never, like, flaws that turn me off. They're flaws that kind of get me engaged in a weird kind of way. Mm-hmm. Like, the imperfections of the movie are... singular.
Yes.
and there are certain scenes that have, like, some of the most egregious flaws, and they sit aside some of the really absolutely strongest things about it. So, no, it's a good one.
All right.
It's a good one.
All yeah. right. Austin, I guess I will ask you, when did you decide that you loved this movie? Was it before, during, or after you watched it?
I think it's difficult to make it through the I'm a good girl number without, like, the movie endearing itself to you, mm-hmm. and Christina endearing herself to you, and Cher in the wings with a drink. Like, all of that scene just, like, encapsulates what's so fun about the movie, and when it, like, knows what it is the most. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably that scene. I keep watching this movie, and I keep finding things that are entertaining about it, and, like, new things that are interesting about it. Do I think Stephen Anton is a great director? No, I do not. Mm-hmm. Do I think that he at least picked an interesting set of influences for this movie? Like, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And did he cast it well? Relatively speaking. You know, yeah. He got some real icons in this movie, and I think that that is important. It's not everything, but it is important.
Mm-hmm.
I can watch this movie at any time. It's a feel-good movie for me.
Mm. I think I fell in love with this movie well before I ever saw it. I saw the trailer, and... I remember my friend and I don't know what movie we were at where the trailer came on, but as soon as we saw it, it was like, we have to see this. Like, it's Cher, it's Xtina, and it's going to be terrible. And we're going to love it. and I think during the course of the film, like, it was better than I was anticipating, you know? Like, there was some, like, fun dialogue, and I, you know, like, there is so much pleasure to be had in just watching Cher do anything. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, a lot of the criticism of the film is, it is warranted, but, like, I also feel like it kind of misses the point, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess I am kind of more attached to burlesque as a cultural object than as an aesthetic object. Like, there are some curious choices. Just
indeed.
Yeah. And I don't, should we, should
I have no idea what you're talking about. You can't possibly be referring to all the shots of Nikki in the wings, like, scowling that go nowhere. Yep. You can't possibly be referring
to
those.
Never,
yeah.
No.
At some point we have to talk about, like, she's just skulking around for the second. Like, yeah. Is she fired? Like, she's not performing. No. Like, she's not, but she's still there.
Scenes, like,
it's like.
So I
just leave.
This anyway, is so not in your order of questions, but I do have a question that, like, as I've been thinking about my most recent screening, like, there has to be another version of this movie where the Nikki plot line is actually a plot line, because everything that happens with Nikki comes out of left field, and it feels like this is an example of where the movie misjudges what it wants to be, because mm-hmm. if it's a, like, backstage musical, then the rivalry between her and Alice should be the thing
right.
that the movie yeah. wants to tell you about, but that's not what burlesque actually wants to be about at all, and so it has no idea what to do with this conflict.
Yeah.
I mean, it's telling that the big blow-up scene occurs between her and Cher,
yeah.
which is an amazing sort of, like, scene, and it's an amazing choice to make that the conflict. But it comes out of left field in the yeah. movie in a way that I find really endearing.
Totally.
As endearing as her, like, comeback to the entire fight was, like, I slept with your husband
yeah.
right after you got home from your honeymoon. And Cher just has a crowbar in the back of her car and swings it into her mirror. It's amazing.
Oh, my God. And remember the first time I saw it, I thought to myself, oh, my God, like, you know, because she gets into the car, because, you know, those who haven't seen it, Nikki is also apparently this huge lush, even though maybe this is just me. I'm like, she doesn't seem that drunk most of the time.
No, she doesn't seem that drunk.
Half the time I'm like, Tess, just, like, let her go on. It's yeah. fine. Like, and it's like slapping such a teetotaler. Yeah. And it's like, she's only had one drink. But that scene, it's like, oh my God, she's driving. Cause she gets in the car, she leaves and she's drunk. And you're like, uh-huh. oh my God, she's got to crash the car.
Oh yeah.
But the whole point of her being in the car is just so Cher can whip out that crowbar and smash the windshield as she's going by.
This is a remarkably, I have to say, for all of the, like, doom and gloom about the financial, like, the health of the burlesque club mm. is the real, like, stakes of the movie, and nothing else matters. There are no stakes for anything else.
Right, yeah. right.
Which is, again, one of these choices that, like, I kind of admire in some ways, but are also completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, just going off the Nikki thing, one thing that, because I completely agree, I think the Nikki character, you're right, there's, like, maybe, like, a director's cut version of this movie, or some version of this movie where that character makes more sense.
Because where did they spend this $55 million anyway?
Right, well, I mean, yeah, exactly. Because I feel like, yeah, like, you feel it, there's, like, a paucity in the Nikki-Ally rivalry. There's also kind of a paucity in the Nikki-Tess, like, they kept saying, like, we built this club, and, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, this mm-hmm. sort of mother-daughter thing that also doesn't always really feel fully fleshed out.
Yeah.
But one thing that, in a way, like, the flaw kind of plays up a strength in the movie, which was said before, which is, like, this is a movie where you could very much imagine the note between the female characters being, like, you know, bitchy comebacks and, like, catfights and whatever. And, like, that really doesn't happen that much, which actually is quite refreshing.
Yeah.
And every time you feel like Nikki is trying to stir something up, and then the movie just kind of, like,
the movie ignores it,
goes away. Exactly. But I feel like, yeah, this speaks to, like, the sort of one of the real good-hearted, yeah. like, pleasurable aspects of that movie, which, like, you were saying, Austin, which is, like, I mean, certainly the relationship between women and gay men, but also the relationship between at least some of the women in the club feel very grounded in common care yeah. and goodness, and that's quite moving.
I think the, like, that's the concluding note for Nikki's story, right, is that she returns to the fold and is maybe kinder, gentler a little bit. She still snaps at the other girl,
yep.
But maybe she's learning to be a little bit better as, like, a teammate and a fellow, a member of the ensemble, yep. right, behind Alice.
Yeah.
So I think you're right that maybe some of the efforts are misjudged, but it also speaks to a project of the movie that's really great mm-hmm. and that I love so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, that speaking of projects, like, I think a big reason for this movie's existence is because there was kind of a, like, renewed interest in burlesque as an art form at this time. And there was also a renewed interest in musicals, right? Or at least there was. This kind of came at the tail end of a kind of wave of Oscar Beatty musical offerings of the early aughts. And so I'm wondering if you can kind of situate it within that specific wave. And how does that, and where does that lineage stem from, right? Like, so is it kind of like, you see the Fosse influence in this, right? It's very clear mm-hmm. that it wants to be Fosse. But where does it end up?
I can't speak a lot to burlesque. I didn't go through the bibliography that Allie does on her bed at the beginning of the film. So I can speak a little bit to just some thoughts on the musical, or just sort of like at least where I think this movie is drawing from in terms of the contemporary musical cycle, I guess, of the aughts, late 90s to the aughts.
Yeah.
I don't know. For me, I completely agree on the Fosse influence. I haven't seen this movie in quite some time, so maybe I'm sort of blending some stuff together in my own head. To me, and I'd love to know your thoughts on this, to me this movie seems pretty indebted to Moulin Rouge in terms of a modern influence. Both in, I mean, there's the, not that it cuts in quite the frenetic pace that like a Baz Luhrmann does, but like it's almost like it's combining the sort of aura and the milieu of Moulin Rouge with some kind of Chicago-y kind of stuff with like how the dance scenes are, the performance scenes are like cut together.
Right.
To the point where like, I mean, the part early on, one of the first lip sync numbers, because you know, one thing we'll talk about, I'm sure, is there's a distinction between before when all the girls lip sync and dance but don't sing live, and then of course when Christina begins to sing live, and that's the sort of second half of the film in the club. But one of the early lip sync scenes is Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, which of course is like, which even the way that eventually Christina's character Allie eventually imagines herself singing that song, even the way that shot reminds me of Nicole Kidman mm-hmm. in Moulin Rouge.
That the shot that you're talking about is incredibly Moulin Rouge.
Yeah,
incredibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then this, so maybe I'll pass this off to Winnie, but just kind of like one thing that struck me. So I guess it's sort of that. I feel like sort of like the aesthetic, both like the mise-en-scène and also the way it's sort of put together feels sort of, at least sort of riffing on Moulin Rouge. Like mm-hmm. it feels different than say like the mid-aughts thing where it's like The Producers and Rent and Phantom, which feel a little more like trying to, I don't know, I guess they're trying to do certain types of sort of references to earlier musicals too, but burlesque seems to be in conversation with Moulin Rouge. But also it's one of those things in the aughts where like, and Moulin Rouge is actually sort of a example of going away from this, but burlesque I think in many ways isn't, the sort of anxiety about how you prompt musical members. Mm-hmm. And burlesque is one of those movies, at times I think to its strength, at times I think to its detriment, that like it doesn't just let the characters burst into song. It always has to be sort of motivated by a performance on a stage, which mm-hmm. I think personally, I'm not someone for whom that's like a hard and fast rule. I think you can do sort of fastidiously motivated musical numbers and make that work. I think Chicago does that pretty mm-hmm. well. Either it's like a performance or it's a dream, sort of a fantasy sequence, or you can just lean in and be like, well, I'm just gonna, it's a musical, they can burst into song, whatever. I feel like even though we're at that point about 10 years into the musical revival in Hollywood, there are times where personally I can feel the movie kind of being like, well, I don't know, will the audience buy it if she just bursts into, I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this eventually, but like, you haven't seen The Last of Me, which to me is one of the real highlights of the movie, mm-hmm. but it's just so odd to me how that number is framed.
Yeah.
Kind of be like, oh, I forgot I was supposed to rehearse this. It's just like,
it's wild.
What? Yeah, exactly. It's like, I think it almost like that song eventually, I think I find that whole scene very moving. And like, I think it sort of transcends the sort of clumsiness of its introduction. But part of me is like, maybe if she just started singing this at like an emotional moment, it would have been a little more, it would have flowed a bit more easily into the emotions of the song.
Right.
Anyway, but I will Yeah. So what do you think of, like, the musical lineage for, or the burlesque? Yeah.
No, I mean, burlesque. So there are some sequences that are very Moulin Rouge. I think I agree. And certainly the setting of the club, the interior of the club, is very, like, Moulin Rouge. And I think if, though Moulin Rouge sort of uses certainly more clear photography. One thing I should have mentioned in my summary of Burlesque is that it's entirely shot through a Vaseline lens in a truly incredible way. Real throwback. Real throwback lensing.
Verging on Drag Race Season 1.
Yeah. Verging. Yeah.
Well, maybe not that much.
They learned from Drag Race Season 1, I think. Yeah. Ooh, boy. So not the lensing necessarily, but certainly the kind of, like, bordello kind of aesthetic. There's a lot of red and pink and a lot of blue in this movie that I think responds very well to the sort of Moulin Rouge palette. There are also some incredibly Chicago sequences. There, fully 20 minutes of this movie takes place in one night.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which I had forgotten until I most recently rewatched this, and I turned to you, Pauline, and I was like, wait, hold on. Did that all take place in, like, one evening? So they intercut this performance in the burlesque club. Christina's singing the song Bound to You, which is a really great vocal performance, and it's a really stunning image, even though one wonders, like, how the club pulled it off, because it looks nothing like anything else in the movie.
Yeah. And that seems like, that number in particular seems like a direct callback to maybe this time from Cabaret, right? The spotlight and stuff. Yeah,
absolutely.
Speaking of color, that beautiful green dress she's wearing.
Oh, like, my God.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, it's a stunning shot. She's lit so beautifully and, like, emoting it so well. The editing of that and the time compression of that is very Chicago to me. But, God, yeah, that Cher number. Like, there's no reason why she can't just find herself alone on the stage and sing that. The only reason that current E! Host Terrence J needs to be there is to turn the spotlight on her.
Yeah. And, like,
but she doesn't even, there's no reason for that.
Right.
She could just have a spotlight on her suddenly.
And to your point about Bound to You, again, like, and when she sings, I guess that makes, it feels a little more whatever when you actually see Bound to You, but I thought about this when I was watching, because she's like, oh, I'm, like, Cher's like, I'm rehearsing a new number for the club. I'm like, if I'm paying $20 to go into this burlesque house, and then I see Cher doing this, like, self-reflective ballad, I'm like, what audience? What audience is gonna be like, what, like, I've been seeing, like, you know, like 2 hours of, like, you know, like, scantily clad dancers and, like, sort of winky winky double entendre songs, and suddenly it's like, this is not the club. You wouldn't sing the song in the club. Anyway.
Is she gonna sing it in the costume that she wears in the number where Allie comes in with the sailor hat on? The inexplicable sailor hat? Because I would watch the number if that was the outfit she was doing.
That's so true. Even more emotional.
Oh, Tess.
Sometimes they're confused, like they forget they're not at a drag club.
Yes. Which is the problem.
Right, yeah.
I will say that on the, like, burlesque influence front, I think Allie does more research about burlesque than the producers do as well. There's not a clear, like, a super clear definition of what burlesque is.
Right.
Yeah.
When Allie starts singing live, it loses a lot of the, like, ba-dunk-dunk kind of, like, dancing.
Yeah.
Which is neither here nor there. There are some really successful, the one number where she's not singing as much or, like, moving around as much, A Guy What Takes His Time, is the best strictly burlesque number in the entire movie. And it's witty and funny, and she's so good in it. And, but the rest of it is more, like, and, you know, this is because Steven Anton is the brother of Robin Anton, who developed the Pussycat Dolls, and most of the backup dancers in this movie without names are former members of the Pussycat Dolls.
Yeah.
It's a lot of Pussycat Dolls light kind of choreography.
Right.
And then we get the Alan Cumming and the contortionist number
randomly,
which is funny.
Yeah.
but offbeat, way out there.
And that to me, speaking of references, I mean, that just seems like literally them just being like, you were the MC in Cabaret.
Yes,
there's
yes.
a song you did called Two Ladies in Cabaret. Mm-hmm. Just do that again.
Yep.
Although one of my favorite parts, one of my favorite pairs of shots in the whole movie, because it's a very sort of like, you know, ostentatiously raunchy number, right? And there's that one part where, like, the contortionists end up in some very sort of sexual position. I think he ends up in, like, the crotch region of one of the dancers, and he just kind of pulls his head up and goes, like, and it's like, yowza, or, like, something like that. And then it cuts to some guy laughing so hard he spits out his drink.
Yes.
And it's like, I just love that. It's so funny.
It's like, this movie is rated PG-13. Like, oh, honey, no.
Maybe we'll get to this. As an aside, I believe friend of the podcast, Matt St. John, right? He's Mount Era, said, I was talking to him recently, and he was like, I love a good PG-13 strip club scene. And
oh,
I feel like
God.
That's a lot of the burlesque aesthetic.
Yes.
Is like, what can you get away with? But I agree, the man who takes his time, whatever.
I forget the actual, like, semantics of the title or the syntax, but yeah.
But yeah, but I agree, like, that's like great PG-13, you know, it's like, because it's very witty, like
sure.
you said,
yeah.
and very fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, like...
Do you think we need an explanation on this podcast for what burlesque is supposed to be? Because it is essentially a PG-13 striptease. That's what burlesque is, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that much about it myself, beyond it's like a Victorian, right? Is that right? I don't know. Maybe I'm just talking.
Well, I feel like there was a lot of, like... early cinema examples of burlesque, right? The very, very early stuff after Muybridge is, like, filming animals running around. It's a lot of ladies taking off their clothes.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes they're taking off more of their clothes than is strictly, like, burlesque.
Right. Right. Yeah. But, I mean, the aesthetic of it, like, the corsets and there's something, they're, like, it's kind of this combination of, like, vintage and new and like the sort of blending.
I feel like there are normally way more nipple tassels in burlesque than there are in this movie.
Yeah.
Feels like they could have done at least one shot of nipple tassels.
Right.
But this is another thing that I will say about this movie, and I don't know if it's a strength or a weakness. This is a really gay movie, lensed by a very gay man, and it like the straight sexuality of the burlesque club just like does not register at all. There is no titillation here present. And if you want it to be a believable burlesque club, then I guess that's a failure. If the movie is about like the people in the burlesque club who are running it and putting on the show, who are women and gay men, then I suppose it makes sense, right? But to your point about that reaction shot of the dude spitting out his drink and laughing at Alan Cumming, it's like, I don't believe it, frankly. Like, we need an audience, like, in the audience in the club needs to be there for plot reasons, but they don't need to be there for aesthetic reasons.
No, totally. Mm-hmm. And also, like, I mean, I completely agree that this is like a vision of heterosexuality imagined entirely by a gay man. And also, like, but the movie also, I find, is that in some ways it does sort of gayness and queerness very well. In other ways, it does it in very kind of, like, almost flat-footed, like, not like mean-spirited, but just kind of flat-footed kind of ways. Like, and we can get to the really good stuff at some point, which I would like to, but, like, you know, we were joking before about, oh my God, Jack, the bite.
Yeah.
The man, yeah.
Love interest.
And yeah, and how Allie thinks he's gay.
Because
he's wearing eyeliner. And then that's sort of like, and that in itself is like, again, talk about like, I don't know, like some vision of gayness where I'm kind of like, oh, like, I guess she's from Iowa, but it's kind of like, I don't know. It's like, it seems a little, but then later on after they finally get together and she's like, well, she brings it back and she's like, well, I know you're not gay. It's like, it's such an odd kind of note to keep hitting, especially when like the movie seems infused with a kind of very fun, appreciative sort of gay aesthetic that, I don't know. So that even the presence of Alan Cumming is very mixed in that regard, because like you cast Alan Cumming, it's kind of like he brings a certain energy, right? A certain queer energy that's sort of undeniable, and yet it's like the movie doesn't really know what to do with him. But then on the other hand, you have all the stuff with Stanley Tucci, and you have, like you were saying, Austin, just like the entire sort of feel and vibe of this entire club feels very sort of I don't know, gay in a good way. Anyway, but that's yeah it's an interesting mix of signals that this movie gives off.
Sure, and I would count Alan Cumming's presence as among the good miscalculations, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like, I think his presence, is he necessary to the plot? Absolutely not. Like, it's kind of a mystery what he's doing there, beyond just, like, signaling to those in the know, like, what we're doing, like, what this movie's about, you know? And so, like, it's the kind of thing, if you have to ask, you don't understand, right?
Like, that's true.
And I appreciate that about the movie. But before we delve into the dudes, let's talk about the ladies still. So I don't know if I want to bring this up now, but since we're talking about queerness, my contention is that Allie, the Christina Aguilera character, is gay.
Go on.
Yeah. So, like, there's a long history of, like, the trope of the young queer female upstart who has to, like, dethrone the aged, wizened, older, like, role model, right? So, like, going back to All About Eve, right? Like, it took me a long time to realize it, but Eve Harrington is definitely gay. Right, it's very, very clear. And so when we have that, we see that same trope in Showgirls, right? Like, Elizabeth Berkley is definitely attracted to Gina Gershon. That's what that movie is about. And so we kind of see remnants of that here, in spite of the, like, weird, Jack Beard guy.
A beard made of eyeliner.
Yeah, exactly.
The Jack, whatever story.
Exactly.
Eyeliner and abs. Don't forget the abs.
Oh, very important.
I don't forget the abs.
That
yeah.
is very, very true. I mean, he makes a compelling case. Like, I do love a famous Amos. I'm just saying, you know. But, you know, like, the way that, like, the Nikki-Allie relationship is, like, kept ambiguous throughout. Like, they seem to be antagonistic towards one another, and it's never really clear why. Like, maybe Nikki's threatened by Allie's talent, and Allie may be a little bit, I don't know, threatened by Nikki's seniority, but, like, the way that they look at each other suggests that there may be something else going on, right? And even at the very beginning of the film, when Christina first arrives at the club, like, what draws her in is the sighting of a woman kind of putting on stockings, right? And, like, there's a shot of her, like, longingly looking at this woman, right? And so the much of the shot compositions and the storytelling kind of suggests that might be a possibility, a possible reading of the film. I don't know. Do you guys buy into it?
I like that reading. I will say that it is not one that maybe speaks to my own biases that jump to the front of mind. But as you're talking about it, I really like that, especially that idea of, like, the sort of, it also really does help to kind of flesh out the Nikki-Allie dynamic, which, again, like, viewed through a lens of, like, they're just rivals, whatever, because she's jealous, so whatever. Yeah, like, is a little, is not a lot there. But I like adding on this other layer.
What if they're flirting?
What if they're flirting? Especially in that final exchange of glances, the sort of, which are appreciative, but also could sort of be...
Hints at something more.
Exactly. I also just want to flag, and also I want to hear what you have to say about this too, but I also want to know what you think about how the movie then, if it's playing off the sort of older, younger woman... The younger woman dethroning the older woman and the older woman being queer, how that layers on to the dynamic between Sharon, Christina in this movie.
Right. That's a great question. Yeah.
I mean, it is difficult for me to... There are so many things that are great about the performances that Cher and Christina give in this movie. I think that there are... And Cher has disavowed this performance for reasons that I don't understand, because I actually she's like, this is the worst movie I've ever been in.
Oh.
And it disappoints me because I don't think that's true. I think she's really good in this. But I also don't think the movie ever gets over the fact that Cher and Christina Aguilera are sharing the screen with one another. Mm-hmm. I think that it's difficult for me to read any kind of, like, I get the Ally Nikki sort of relationship, but it's difficult for me to see any kind of, any shades of that development in the Ally Tess relationship, just because we only sort of get the movie never assumes that Ally is any threat to Tess in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Cher is unimpeachable in this movie. And Tess, as a result, is unimpeachable in this movie.
Right.
She only barely gets, like, character flaws. And only Stanley Tucci gets to call them out.
Right.
Right? which is part of the strength. That relationship is probably the most developed relationship, and I think it's such a delightful relationship. But it also means that other relationships within the movie, especially the Tess-Ally dynamic, kind of don't develop in the same way.
Right, right, yeah. I think it's relying on a kind of shorthand, right? Like, we are meant to understand that this is a mother-daughter relationship. Mm. They have the one scene where Tess puts on Allie's makeup, and I think we understand all we need to know, right?
I'm looking for the line that she says in that scene, because I wrote it down.
Okay.
Because it's too much. It's like, when you're doing your makeup, pretend you're an artist, but instead of painting a canvas, you're painting a face. Yeah.
That's just sound advice.
It really is.
And you know what? The strength of Cher as an actress is that she almost sells that line. She's so close, but you cannot ultimately overcome how bad, how wooden that line is.
That is a wooden line, although I will say, I mean, that to me might be my favorite scene in the movie.
It's so good.
It's very, I mean, like, and the two of them are very good in that scene. Yeah. Like, again, better than they should be. Mm-hmm. Like, better than that scene, really. But, like, when Cher is talking about her mother, the model, and her girlfriends would come over and they put on their, just, there's something just very real and tender about that scene that, like, is surprising. Whenever I watched it, I was like, I didn't remember it being that good.
Yeah, I think.
Anyway,
I mean, I know I have continuously throughout the course of this podcast referred to their characters as Cher and Xtina or Christina, but I think in that one scene, in that scene alone, that's where they actually are the characters.
Definitely.
And not their personas.
Yeah,
right.
Like, totally. When they're on screen together.
Exactly.
Certainly.
Yeah. So I think that's why that scene stands out so much.
She's so human and, like, motherly and tired in this movie. Like, you really, like, that the reason I love her number so much, her, like, 11th hour sort of, like, barn burner I'm alone on a stage number, that expresses how, like, it literalizes it a little too much maybe in the lyrics, but, like, that's what the performance is. It's like Tess is a worn out kind of, she's worn out from, like, running this business. Mm-hmm. And there's something so powerful about her, like, taking Ally eventually under her wing once Ally proves herself to be like, hey, you're going to make it. Like, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So Cher obviously has, this is not her first rodeo. This is not her first burlesque. So,
could you possibly mean by that?
she had one or two other roles as a celebrity, just as a public figure. She's been in the public eye for a very long time, right?
She has indeed.
And Christina had too, believe it or not. And so, like, part of what I find so interesting about this movie is kind of the weird timing and the kind of, I want to talk to these women's agents and, like, find out what the motivation was for taking these roles, because like Cher's motivation seems like pretty clear. Like, it's a new movie. She gets to be the star, and she gets, like, it's a, I don't know how frequently, like, roles come her way, especially ones that give her the, agency and respect, something like this. But Christina Aguilera at this point in her career had put out, I want to say, four, like, three or four, like, top-selling albums. And Bionic had just come out, right?
Or was about to come out.
Three
albums in a greatest hits collection. Okay. By this point.
Okay.
For sure.
And yet, somehow, someone thought it would be a good idea for her to play the young ingenue.
True.
Right? And that's such a curious choice. And I'm not saying, like, it doesn't work. Because I think, like, there is a kind of naivete to her performance, and she sells it pretty well. But, like, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm watching it, I never forget that it's Christina Aguilera. It is Xtina, you know? So, like, that's such a curious choice. Like, is this a way for her to kind of wipe the slate clean of that whole dirty era? Like, are we just supposed to forget about the assless chaps, or...
Never.
I mean, who can ever forget those?
What? Well, I was going to say, so there was the dirty era, and then, and admittedly, you know, I took a little winding road through Christina's discography en route to this podcast. And there was that whole, and this, and again, speaking of timing, this itself was about 4 years old by the time this movie came out, but
Back to Basics.
And her new alter ego, which was, I forgot, it was called, according to Wikipedia, was called Baby Jane.
Baby Jane.
Which was... I mean,
a woman after my own heart.
Right, exactly. But also, and I wonder what you two think about this, like, speaking of influences, like, I mean, her whole kind of mid-aughts Back to Basics, kind of like, I'm doing like a sort of like a retro pop, like, I'm gonna, it's sort of like a knowing 50s throwback with like Candyman and whatever.
And the purposeful, like, Marilyn reinvention for her image.
Yes. How much of that do you think ends up, because that seems to be in the mix in terms of her performance and the aesthetic of some of those numbers, too.
Right, exactly.
I don't know. Do you think that's...
I Am a Good Girl is very much a, like, Marilyn imitation. Mm-hmm. And not in a bad way. Like, it's a fun, campy Marilyn imitation, you know? I think that we don't underappreciate Marilyn for her physical comedy chops.
Yes.
But lots of people do.
Yeah.
And Christina certainly doesn't, because I think her performance in this takes a lot of cues from it, right? But it does seem like an aesthetic miscalculation if you are coming out of the Back to Basics era, which did very well, and Candyman and Ain't No Other Man, these songs were, like, major hits, and you have this public sort of reinvention of your image. She's promoting the Bionic album at the same time as this movie is coming out, and it's just such a weird dichotomy between what this movie is trying to do with her image, which is make her the young ingenue, the young blonde, sort of like trying to cast her in this like Marilyn sort of thing. Yeah, the ingenue cue, by the way, her development into like a megastar is wearing a wig to have shorter hair, which was actually Christina's hair at the time. The longer part was a wig.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you. We hadn't spent enough time on the wigs in this movie.
Oh,
that needed hat.
That's a whole other podcast.
Oh boy. Yeah, it seems like such an aesthetic miscalculation, and there are so many things to blame for why that Bionic album didn't do very well. But I feel like one of them is trying to tie this movie to that album, and they are very different projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wildly different projects.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I think it also speaks to, like, the... You talked about how, with the exception of a couple scenes, like, you know, purposefully, you never really forget Cher is Cher, you never really forget Christina is Christina. But it also made me think about watching the two of them. It's like, okay, if you're going to assume that, like, okay, it's always them on screen, so they purposely bring all of their various career connotations with them. Cher, I mean, Cher is obviously, you know, known for her sort of chameleon-esque kind of, you know, different phases, different looks, different eras of Cher. But for me, there is this through line, particularly in the past maybe 15, 20 years of Cher. Maybe this is like sort of like the gay male thing too, of like the sort of like the indomitable diva, but like this sense of like, you know, strength and attitude in the face of adversary that like is kind of a pretty strong through line. So when you see it in this movie, you're like, yeah, like that makes sense. And with Christina, I love Christina, but like her various persona changes over the years have always felt to me a little more like disjunctive. You know what I mean? Like, and I feel like the through line has always been, but God, she can sing.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, she's always had it's like the voice, you know, especially when other singers who are just as famous, like maybe less known for their vocal, And so it's interesting.
Shall remain nameless?
Exactly. I mean, and I love a lot of those singers too. Yeah, don't get me wrong, but it's like, but it's interesting seeing. It's like the ingenue thing this movie's trying to do with her. It's like you can kind of read it, but it feels less in terms of like the connotations of Christina. It almost kind of like it short circuits a bit for me, in part because it's like I don't really know if I think of her as like the ingenue in a way that I think of Cher, even when Cher was younger, as kind of like, you know, the indomitable woman, you know, the kind of like always with a comeback, always with a belting, you know, kind of power belt, you know, so do you think that sort of factors into how we read the performances as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. I that's actually extremely well said. I mean, that I think you've kind of highlighted part of what's sort of a little bit strange about the movie, and also, kind of fits into the theme of the movie a little bit too, where, I mean, you know, think about burlesque as an art form, think about when this came out and who stars in it, and everything just feels a little bit like dated. You know, there's something
certainly like out of its time.
Maybe dated is not like that's too pejorative, but yeah, it is something out of its time. There's something like it's going for retro, right? Mm-hmm. But when this style of retro had sort of like had its moment and that moment had gone, right? Christina hadn't been an ingenue in a long time. The OC had been off the air for a number of years when this movie came out. Like everything about it is kind of like it had just been like taken out of mothballs and someone forgot to like dust it off, you know what I mean? Like there's something a little bit like aged about it. And I think that's part of its camp value. And that's again part of why I like it, you know?
Yeah.
Like you watch this movie and it doesn't feel like a movie that was made in 2010, right?
It does not, no.
Yeah. Yeah, everything about it feels somehow like, yeah, dated. I'm going to stick with dated, but in a good way.
Yeah. this is fully unintentional, but it's funny thinking in hindsight, like the November of 2010, if you were to ask someone, like, what's the most relevant form of the musical and culture? It would be Glee.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And so it's really...
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's very funny when Deanna Agron storms in at the end of the movie. It's almost sort of like ruining the party. You
know? Yeah.
Quite literally, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, my God.
No, but I agree. It's like, it feels... I think it's simple, but it feels very, like, out of step. I mean, obviously, it's retro, but it feels out of step with, like, what... where the culture was, even with like the musicals,
right.
But I agree, it's an odd thing, but it's not necessarily a bad thing in terms of its pleasure. Yeah,
and the movie's about trying to stay relevant, so it's perfect, right?
Yeah.
Like it fits in well with it's the theme of the movie, right?
Yeah.
And another artist who was coming to prominence at the time was Lady Gaga.
Yes.
Like Gaga had come out with Bad Romance a couple years prior, and here we are still doing Burlesque, you know what I mean? Gaga had set the world on fire, and like I feel like part of maybe why someone like Christina wanted to distance herself from this is because like that was such a game changer, you know, like that whole sort of how would you describe Gaga's first few records? Electro. Like,
but here's the thing. Then Christina goes and does the album that's the Sexy Fembot album.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, wasn't 2010 Born This Way? Yeah?
Yeah. Or maybe early 2011. No, I don't know. It was after 2010 or early 2011.
Yeah. Which is like a metal-esque, like more of a heavier album, but there are also a lot of like sort of electronic, computerized, kind of like machinic... voices in that album.
Sure.
Which definitely is a strength of it for me. I love that album so much.
Yeah.
God, this all comes back to Madonna, doesn't it? This movie has an amazing Madonna needle drop in it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And then has a bunch of awful needle drops of pop songs.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it really didn't need to spend that money on those pop songs. No. That's the thing to me that makes it feel the most, like, dated, yeah. is these pop music drops, which were definitely maybe popular when the film was being made, but as soon as it's in theaters, it's like, we don't need this.
Yeah.
No.
But then there's, like, Alphaville. Like, why?
Oh, I know.
Oh, God. What's that song? Is that... What's the song that is over when... Allie and Marcus are driving to the park. Like that, That was the one that just felt most like needles, like nails on the chalkboard.
Exactly.
That,
is that the like,
here we go
again?
Yes,
whatever. That one.
I'm just like, and it's like, why'd you spend the money on this? Because it feels so, in a way that like the Madonna, like in the way that Ray of Light, like, I mean, not that it's, I mean, whatever, that, maybe that's like out of its time too at this point, but like it always sort of feels relevant. To me, anyway. Right. But I feel like in that movie, like, a Madonna... Throwing Madonna in, given the milieu, feels kind of like, okay, like, this makes sense, right?
It gets that it's that type of movie. Yeah. Like, I don't understand what that song is supposed to communicate about that character.
No.
Or, like, the pop... I don't know what pop song is playing in the background while they're at the party at his house, but that's also, like... Why is this music playing? You know, why doesn't he have like a, he's a rich asshole. Why doesn't he have some like jazz pianist who's the only black person at the party playing the piano? Like I don't know.
La La Land was later.
That is why we had you on this podcast right there.
Thank you. You earned your keep.
Oh, also in my keep and say, because I actually looked up the name of the song that was playing in the background.
Oh my God.
I forget the action, but it's like, it's Carrie Hilson. Like when love comes, it's like when love comes around, but the actual name of the song is like Knock You Down or something like that, or Knock You, whatever, which I actually like.
That song. Sure. Okay.
But I agree. It's completely like,
why is
you just
there?
Wanted to put this, what to like, put it on the soundtrack. I don't know, it's like, why is it here? Yeah.
I mean, I think you're right. I think that's where a lot of the budget went, and I'm wondering why.
Right.
But some questions we could, like...
Some questions are too difficult to answer.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the great mysteries of the universe, you know? Like, just, like, you know, on sleepless nights, you can think about it and wonder, you know?
And I do.
When you're sleeping on your daybed and your friends... Your friend's quote unquote apartment.
Yes, your friend's apartment.
Oh my God. All right.
Because when a friend is in trouble, I'm the type of person who helps them out.
Amen.
Okay. Well, did we talk about Stanley Tucci enough? Alan Tucci.
Alan Tucci. I think we can talk about him a little bit more.
Okay.
But that's just my own
bias is coming through.
Like, same. Yeah. When did Stanley Tucci become... Yeah, when did the gay dad persona develop? Like, that was it Devil Wears Prada?
I feel like that's the origin of, like, that popular kind of, like, the popularization of that Stanley Tucci performance.
Yeah, but has he always secretly been that guy?
He is that guy.
He is that
like,
guy.
This is, for the record, this is not me saying that Stanley Tucci is gay. By all accounts, he seems to be married and have a family and has a really great hetero life, and I congratulate him on it.
Yeah.
But he, this is why I love him so much, has an amazing empathy for the gay experience when he is playing these characters. Mm-hmm. Devil Wears Prada, there's that amazing scene in the hotel room with him and Anne Hathaway where he talks about all the work that he's gone through to get where he is, and then he's not going to get that position, and you only know that if you've like watched the movie multiple times.
Yeah.
And it's so heartbreaking. And this movie is such a lived-in portrayal of this friendship between his character and Tess. And I love, it's a throwaway scene, but when they're dancing at Julianne Hough's character's ridiculously lavish wedding because her husband is loaded, like, I love
but he
that.
Also works at the club? Or does he work at the club? I don't know.
No, his parents are wealthy. The club, but his parents are wealthy. Because they're really down to, like, pay for a lavish wedding to a burlesque dancer. Anyway.
Also, just as an aside, one of Kristen Bell's best line readings when they're talking about the dad being rich, and she's like, is he single? I'm just kidding. But then she has that great look.
No, she's not kidding. She's very clearly not kidding. Nikki will fuck your dad. No, there's just this throwaway moment where they're dancing with one another, and Cher talks about how, like, wonderful their love for one another is, but she's just like, well, I'll never get to have you because you're tragically gay, except for that one night in, like, Albuquerque or Reno. I forget exactly what it is, and you were drunk and you don't remember, and then he's just like, I remember everything. It was magical. You'll always have my heart. And it's just like, so that friendship is so heartwarming and so delightful. And it's such a little, like, we don't get that kind of gay character often enough. Like, friendships between gay men and straight women have very particular scripts. And this is not one of them, because it's not played for comedy. It's not played for laughs. It's like a genuine kind of, like, emotional moment between them. It's just, he sells it so well. It's beautiful.
It's almost kind of like this performance too. I completely agree with that, and I love that scene. It's such a, and it's such like a, it is such a lived in moment and a lived in performance. Like, to me, like, Tucci in this movie almost feels like it's combining Stanley Tucci and Devil Wears Prada and Stanley Tucci and Julie and Julia.
Yes.
It's one performance. Yes. It's kind of like, when it's like, it has all the kind of, the very sort of empathetic sort of portrayal of, like, a gay man, especially, like, a gay man of a certain age, too, which I feel like you also don't always see, with that kind of, like, very easy, familiar, warm back and forth with a female co-star. One thing, I went back and forth watching it again, and at first I was like, oh, this is a little weird, but the more I thought about it, the more I liked it, and I'm not sure if, I'd love to know what you two think of this, like, is it just me? The movie feels almost a little bit, when you first watch it, almost feels a little bit coy about what exactly Cher and Stanley Tucci's relationship is. In the sense that, like, it's like, just in the sense that, like, it's not like within the first scene, Cher's being like, oh, like, how many guys have you slept with? I forget what his name is, whatever the character's name. But it's like, they have such a rapport with one another. And then it's like, it takes a while for the movie to really confirm that Stanley Tucci's character is gay. I mean, you kind of know he's gay, but, like, it doesn't do the sort of easy, like, okay, we're gonna mark off, like, who's, what the sexualities are, and, you know, he's gay and she's straight. It's, like, a little more, it feels a little more in flux. And ultimately that feels like a strength, because it kind of, like, it blends, like, their intimacy feels very fluid, in a way that it's not just, like, he's over here, she's over here, and they're going to have the standard issue, quippy, gay male, you know, straight female kind of relationship thing. But I don't know. I'm not sure what that was your reading of it when you first saw it.
Yeah, I mean, they establish early on that, Tess is very good at maintaining male friendships. Like, she's still friends with her ex-husband.
Oh, yeah. A very sweaty Peter Gallagher.
Yes. Very sweaty. Very sweaty.
I can relate.
Yeah, I mean, me too. Right now, honestly,
very hot here. But, I mean, I keep bringing up the OC, and I think it's worth mentioning, like, you know, Peter Gallagher's in this, and Jack, the love interest, both OC cast-offs. So, I don't know, like, I don't know what he's doing there beyond establishing that, like, Cher is a good friend. Like, do you have any thoughts about what, like, what he's doing there and how that relates to the Stanley Tucci character? I don't know. Like, it's very curious. Like, is he meant to be, like, this alternative to Tucci? Like, are they sort of pitted against each other? It doesn't ever feel that way, right? Like, he seems to be very understanding of Tess's relationship, and seems to understand that her relationship with Tucci is paramount and is perfectly fine with that. And, like, there's like a respect there, especially considering that they're ex-spouses. And so, like, throughout this movie, where you think there's going to be conflict, they just punt it, or, like, but it's like in a delightful way, you know, like,
and it shows up in the weirdest places.
Yes.
I mean, in even the presumed bad guy, like, do we need to talk about McSteamy? Sure.
Yeah. We're going down the list.
We've talked about the other presumed villain of the movie, so I...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The actual... Here's the thing. The actual villain of this movie is capitalism.
Sure. Yeah.
That's true.
Like, yes. If Cher could just run this burlesque club and make whatever money she was making and not have to worry about paying... you know, the lease or the mortgage on this club, then everything would be fine.
Mm-hmm. True.
But that's not how it works. And so she has to, like, I feel like, to the point about Peter Gallagher, he's mostly just there for plot reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think it does lend this really ambiguous sort of thing to the relationship between Cher, between Tess and Stanley Tucci's character, right? Mm-hmm. I do think that it plays that really nicely. And I think the opening parts of the movie play that really nicely, because that could have been so nasty and so catty in a way yes. that, like, you know, I know that Stanley Tucci would not have allowed it to be that way. Mm-hmm. This movie also, we should mention, was rewritten at some point in its life cycle by both Diablo Cody and Susanna Grant of mm-hmm. Erin Brockovich. And you can... It feels like there are still one-liners from Diablo Cody, certainly, in this movie.
Yeah.
The sort of proto-Diablo Cody lines, the mutant lungs line that yeah. you reference at the top of the podcast certainly feels like yeah. one of those. But this is not, it's an occasionally a wooden script, but it's not a terrible one. It's not necessarily, outside of the eyeliner lines, which are just, like, why do that?
Yeah.
It's not a terrible script. Right. Like, it leaves the actors a lot of room to do things with those characters and makes particularly the relationship between Cher and Stanley Tucci feel very real. The scene where he convinces her to, like, be okay when she feels like the dark night of the soul for her is so delightful, when he's, like, purposefully antagonizing her and then he's just like, there she is. Thought I yeah. lost her for a minute. Like, it's so good.
Yeah. I agree with you on the ultimate villain being capitalism. It's also funny how, like, the solution is kind of like a negotiation with capitalism.
Right.
I know.
We're gonna partner with one real estate developer to overcome another real estate developer.
Oh my god.
It's like, well, you know, it's like gotta work with what you got, right?
But you know what? This movie is underappreciated for bringing air rights to national attention.
So true.
People need to know.
People need to know about air rights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently they're very useful if one is.
God. Every arts organization should know about air rights, yes.
right?
Just in case yes. someone starts developing things near you.
All right. And with that, it is time for a vote. Yes, we got to vote.
Were you prepared for this,
yeah.
Matt? I was unprepared for a vote.
I was about to say,
I didn't do my research.
I know every number.
While, like, this is a sanctified list. I mean, I don't let things in to the FlixWise favorites list all willy nilly, right? So I just want us to consider carefully whether we think Burlesque should be included among the greatest movies of all time. And I'm gonna allow Austin some additional space to just talk about how he thinks this whole project is dumb.
If you let people sing instead of lip sync, it would be better.
No one wants that.
Oh my god. Okay, so I don't know. What do you think? Yay or nay? One of the greatest movies of all time?
I want it to be included on the FlixWise favorites list. I don't know why greatest movies of all time has such particular connotations, right? About aesthetic merit or about, what are the criteria of these things, right? And I think that certainly there are regimes of value that have determined for film in particular, and increasingly in television, to my total dismay, that there is accorded a higher sense of value for things that have aesthetic sort of markers of achievement, that have that visibly pay homage to the legacy of quality visual art from a Western context in particular, but certainly other traditions as well. yeah, this is one of the greatest movies of all time, right? Okay. It's so much fun and joyful and features two divas on screen playing off of each other. Three, if you count Stanley Tucci, as I do.
And coming, for that matter.
It's, yeah, and coming. I mean, it's got some lines, it's got wit. Does it have the range fully? Christina does, but maybe the movie doesn't. I think that... I don't know. Yes, you're right. I question the whole premise, but for the reasons that I question the entire premise, I am all a go for voting it in.
Okay. All right.
Ooh.
Matt, thank.
So I very much hear you on the unthinking way that people bring criteria to lists and to canons, often very uncritically, and sort of end up like internalizing a lot of stuff that is that are criteria, but just kind of get swept under the rug of like, well, it's just like, it's good. It's good filmmaking. It's good. You know, it comes from a good place. It's saying good things, etc. I'm all for overturning that as well. If I have a hesitation, look at me like, oh my god.
If I have a hesitation, I'm just curious about what hesitation could you possibly have?
Well, if I have a hesitation about Burlesque, it's only that I feel like if there's Burlesque exists within a register and a tradition of movies that I have deep love for,
yes.
You know, the musical, the backstage musical, mm-hmm. the female friendship film, the mm-hmm. kind, you know, the and there are so many things I like about Burlesque. It also does have enough flaws that that's what holds me back. Mm-hmm. Like not the way that Burlesque, to loop back to the very early part of the conversation, the rhetoric around this movie and a lot of movies of its ilk where it's like, it's campy, it's stupid, like, you know, for that reason alone, I want to agree with you full throatedly. I'm not sure if it's like a strict up or down. I feel like I've been inclined to go yes as well, but I would say that like Burlesque is a movie that I feel like has a lot of internal tensions that make it interesting, but also make it maybe not quite the as fully rounded anesthetic object that I would have liked it to be.
Did I mention it's badly directed? It's badly directed. All right.
I mean, thank you. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's like, so it's like, on the one hand, it's like, who cares? But also in front of me, it's like, I don't know. Maybe I care. So I don't know. So this doesn't feel in the spirit of this to say, to not give a yes or no. So I will give a qualified yes, but I'll give a yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the...
Watch that Pauline say no.
It's like, oh, damn it. After all that.
you are well within your rights to say no, because, you know, like, I think everything you've said is perfectly legitimate, mm-hmm. right? And, like, badly directed is a pretty sizable flaw, you know? Like, it's difficult to overlook.
It's not incompetently directed.
Sure. No,
it's just... Oh, are we not done?
We're going in an hour or two of this podcast.
I mean, I think that some of the shortcomings of the film, like, it's bumping into things that someone like Rob Marshall is also bumping up against. Like, some of the performances, some of the performers have their limitations, mm-hmm. right? Like, we are not dealing with Fred Astaire here. Like, Christina Aguilera does her very best.
She is less convincing in the dance sequences than she is in other parts of the movie.
Sure,
That's very true.
And I don't know, as far as, like, style, so much of this movie feels very derivative. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, one could, like, spin it and say, it wears its influences on its sleeve. But I just don't think that it surpasses any of its influences, right? Like, we know exactly, like, it's basically just, like, grafting these other things onto this movie in this kind of often very strange, disjunctive way, you know? And the way that the film kind of has these very strange relationship with temporality, and like, we don't really know when it takes place and how much time has elapsed throughout the course of the film. And that is both a strength and a weakness, right? Like, I am certainly open to saying, like, no, I don't think so. This is, like, there's a lot of very legitimate, like, things that don't quite work. I think what gives me, what I want to, the reason I want to say yes is because, and maybe you guys can help me with this, like, I have a very strong emotional attachment to the movie, mm-hmm. you know, and I know I'm not alone. And so it's hard for me to untangle my, like, feelings about the film and my associations with, like, its actual, like, formal merit. And I don't know, maybe you, like, I would like you both to kind of talk me into it, yes, frankly, like, and this is sort of a question we kind of skipped a little bit, but, like, what does burlesque mean as a cultural artifact, right? Like, when you tell someone you like burlesque, what are you saying, you know? Because you're saying something, right? Like, it's very intentional.
Well, I like to think that I'm just saying that I like burlesque.
Okay, all right.
I know that that is not the case, okay. However.
Some people do. Some people do just love burlesque, and they're happy to say it, and that's all that it means. You know, that's, yeah.
I think two things. One, I don't know that I necessarily want to put the way that things make me feel and their affective sort of merit and quality, though more ephemeral than sort of artistic merit and aesthetic merit, I don't know that I want to weigh them less in my life than aesthetic merit. I think that that might be something that my proselytizing on behalf of burlesque says about me. Probably also something about diva worship and my unending crush on Stanley Tucci. But I think that burlesque as a cultural object, it's kind of a niche choice. Gotta be honest. Like, this movie did not make a lot of money. Certainly not much more than its budget. It grossed $90 million globally. but has had a large second life on DVD. Mm-hmm. Good, healthy, you know, DVD sales, for especially when it came out in the life of the DVD as a material media object. So I think it, in addition to saying I'm gay, it says, I don't know, it says something about, like, appreciating things as mixed kind of cultural objects, right? It is a chimera of a film in a lot of ways, but it's a cute one that mm-hmm. I want to cuddle up with at night and pet and take selfies with. Like, I this movie just makes me feel really good.
Okay, so, right.
Very well put. I will add to that that I think there is, because I very much sympathize with what you're saying, Paul. I feel like there is, like, the thing about the movie as a cultural object is that it is at once sort of very of its time and very out of its time,
yes.
You know? And, like, that's a, if nothing else, that is a singular or near singular quality to it. Mm-hmm. And a way that, like, there are other movies, it's like there are other movies that fall into a general category of cultural disrepute that I like and that I think are actually much better aesthetically than people give them credit for. And then there's movies that really are culturally disreputable and really, like, aren't that aesthetically interesting, but it has some kind of, like, there's some kind of pull. Mm-hmm. And I feel like burlesque falls in the middle for me mm-hmm. with those, where it's like, it has, I think, legitimate aesthetic problems. And it's not like the kind of thing where it's like, for me, it's not like the affect is not so overwhelming or constant with the movie that I'm like, I can brush those aside with, like,
yeah.
without a care in the world. I think they're connected, obviously, right? Obviously, the aesthetic choices affect the affective experience. And yet, I think there's also something about its mix of good and bad that is, there's something kind of indelible about it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's like, I guess, like, maybe I'm still a bit hung up with my own interpretations of what canon means, that sure. I'm like, well, like, you know, like, why not put, I mean, to take a movie that we talked about briefly earlier, like, I would have no problem putting The Devil Wears Prada on the greatest films of all time list.
Yes.
Okay.
Because to me, that's, I mean, also not a perfect film, but like a film that I feel like coheres better than, and that I have a lot of effective attachment to and a lot of aesthetic appreciation mm-hmm. for. Burlesque falls a little more in the middle for me, so hence my hesitation. But I think it is important to like hang on to that quality of like that certain something. Yeah. There is that certain something.
Yeah, there is a kind of singularity to it yeah. that I think needs to be acknowledged and celebrated. And I mean, you know, like someone could come at me if. Like, there are potentially people out there who want to submit the Goonies to the FlixWise favorites list. And, what is my rebuttal then when they tell me, like, I just, like, have such fond memories of it and I just really, really like it. When I watch it and, like, I don't have those fond associations, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so, it's tricky when, like, your attachment is so ephemeral, but I do think there is something to be said for, like, how strange this movie is, you know? And, like, that it exists and that it is so beloved by a certain subset of the population. And it's not just gay people. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's gay people
But gay people and eyeliner wearing bartenders.
It's true.
Unite.
And I have to say, like, part of why I love this movie is because it does, like, induce such head scratching in like heterosexual men, or it's just like they just don't get it at all. And like there's definitely something to be said for that. I love like any movie that's like kind of like like actively befuddling to straight men. So, like on those grounds, I'm gonna say a tentative yes, and like maybe this can be one we revisit. You know, like this is one because it is so tentative. Like I wonder if my because it is so like feelings based, like I wonder if my feelings will change over time, like and as I change, perhaps my relationship with this film will as well. But with that, I think we got a unanimous vote. It's in.
Hey now.
All right, yay.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Before, no.
All right, listeners, what do you think of Burlesque? Misunderstood masterpiece, significant cultural artifact, piece of garbage? Come let us know what you think on our website, flixwise.com, or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. And if you want to come talk to me over on Twitter, the handle is @flixwise. Obviously, Team Britney ears need not apply. All right, coming up soon on FlixWise, we have Claire Denis' Beau Travail. We've got a Lubitsch double feature, and I believe we're going to do the Seventh Seal to commemorate the Bergman Centennial. So stay tuned for that. Lots of exciting stuff coming up. Until then, Matt, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
It's great to be here.
If people want to track down your writing or your work, where can they find your stuff?
The academic stuff is unfortunately behind a bunch of paywalls.
Oh, gotcha.
So much you have an institutional access. But I also do some occasional writing for Reverse Shot, which is very much not behind a paywall.
Yes.
And you should definitely go to... certainly read my stuff if you would like, but everything on there is well worth your time.
Yeah, and there's some good Alan Cumming material on that on that website. Worth looking at. written by Matt. I'm referring to the Two Cents article.
The Two Cents article, yeah. His other performance besides Burlesque.
Worth checking out. I can link it on the show page.
Thank you.
And Austin, at long last, we did it!
We did it.
Yay!
Thank you for indulging me and inviting me after my persistence to get this podcast made.
I love it. Are you kidding?
It's been a delightful experience.
You're like the alley of this podcast.
So true.
just because you're so persistent.
Yeah. Will I also have a Marilyn Monroe transformation eventually? Because I will accept.
I will buy you a wig. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Is that a Halloween costume?
You know how I feel about Halloween.
Sore subject. Oh, God. All right. Well, where can people find you on the internet?
People can find me on Twitter at Austin, AUSTIN, dot spelled out, DOTTV. That's at Austin.TV. They'll know when I have academic stuff there, and otherwise they will read my thoughts on why canons are bullshit and why Facebook is evil. So,
all right, beautiful. Okay, well, until next time, cheers, dolls.
A guy what takes his time, I'll go for any time. I'm a fast-moving gal who likes him slow. Got no use for fancy driving. Wanna see you got around.